Hi, this is Barry List at Informs, the Institute for Operations Research and the Management Sciences. You're listening to Science of Better, a series of podcasts about ways that analytics and math modeling help people like you and organizations like your own. How are analytics and operations research intertwined with today's sports world, with the American legal system, and with the two of them together? In today's segment, we talk to Ryan M. Rodenberg, an assistant professor of sports management at Florida State University, Anastasios Kabarakis, an assistant professor of management and sports business at St. Louis University. Both have law degrees. Together, they're the author of Sports Law Analytics, which appears in the current issue of Analytics Magazine. Professor Rodenberg, welcome to the Science of Better.
Thank you, Barry. I appreciate it.
Professor Kabarakis, welcome.
Thank you, Barry.
And I should note that Professor Rodenberg will be leaving a little bit early today. And how did you become interested in sports law, Dr. Rodenberg?
Fairly unique story for me. I was a college undergraduate in the mid-90s, and a movie called Jerry Maguire came out. It was very popular. It was very popular, and I saw the movie. I saw it twice, and I somewhat caught the sports law bug, so to speak. The following year, I wrote an undergraduate thesis on business model for sports agents and how they collect fees and how they make money. I used that, I paperclipped that to a couple cover letters while I was in law school, eventually procured an internship with a prominent global sports agency, and actually after I graduated from law school in 2000, I ended up working for them full-time for four full years before eventually going back and getting a PhD.
Now, we're working our way towards the subject of your article, and my first question on that way is, from your perspective, how is analytics used in sports? And why don't we continue with you, Dr. Rodenberg?
Sure. It's multifaceted, and the foundation of analytics and how it extends to the sports world, particularly sports law, is something we tried to focus on in the article, and certainly the high-profile, somewhat glamorous aspect of this is the expert witnesses who testify in trial, and whether they're antitrust trials or intellectual property litigation. These are the experts who testify. They probably make $1,000 an hour to testify, probably make several hundred dollars an hour prepping for their expert testimony. But actually, analytics manifest themselves in a lot of different ways outside the courtroom, and I used a few descriptors in the paper, and it's something that's fairly common. But, for example, in American baseball, one aspect that when players and management, the team, simply don't agree on how much their salary could be, the underlying collective bargaining agreement actually has a mandatory arbitration clause. And both sides, the player side as represented by an agent, as well as the team side, they go to mandatory arbitration before an arbitrator. And both sides use analytics to try to persuade the arbitrator how much money this player is deserving. That's one example outside the courtroom. In addition, I kind of describe this as pre-litigation. But increasingly, given the high stakes and large monetary amounts of the disputes in the sports industry that sometimes make them their way to the courtroom, a lot of plaintiffs as well as defendants are using analytics in kind of a pre-litigation mechanism, really to flush out whether they have a good suit to begin with, and then secondly, on the defense side, whether they should settle the lawsuit before the trial starts. So those are two pretty concrete examples of how increasingly analytics are really being used in legal disputes, but that's not always necessarily when you're in the courtroom. And frankly, my guess is that's a minority in the case of when analytics are actually used.
Professor Kabarakis, did you want to touch on how analytics is used in the courtroom?
Well, for sure, as Ryan mentioned earlier, there are just so many different ways that you can use analytics nowadays, pre-litigation, during litigation. It's just fascinating. We focused quite a bit on the recent litigation stream surrounding the NCAA and amateurism policy issues that was a major part of my research and our collective research group's area of focus.
And we'll talk about that a little bit more in detail in a moment.
Indeed, and that gives us an example of cases where you need some solid evidence. It could come from a survey, it could come from expert witnesses, and different ways of applying research and analytics methods, in particular, to show either how one reaches a decision on value, how one reaches a decision on how perhaps one group leads to consenting or not. Conceptual pieces have been focusing on perceptions of different groups that are very important in terms of court decisions as well.
On to the heart of the article that you've written for Analytics Magazine. The two of you write about one important piece of litigation in this area, and let me quote your article. Quote, as a prime example, Sean Assale of ESPN recently described the ongoing litigation involving the NCAA licensing of former student athletes' names and likenesses in video games as one of five lawsuits that will change sports. What are the two cases involved here, and why is it possible that they'll have such a profound effect on sports in America today?
Right around the same time, we had the actual filing of the first case, which was Keller versus the NCAA, also the collegiate licensing company, and Electronic Arts, the manufacturer of the video games, arguing that the student athletes' intellectual property rights of publicity were violated by such use of their images and likenesses in the video games. And 2 months later came the antitrust portion of the of that litigation. So O'Bannon versus the NCAA is the other portion. So you had the historic figure of the UCLA team back in the mid-90s leading the class that was suing on pretty much the similar grounds that many other classes and cases have brought forth in the past in terms of antitrust challenges of NCAA rules, but this was somewhat different because it dealt with student athletes that had exhausted eligibility and they wanted to claim that their rights were violated. And they wanted to get this treated in these court decisions. And one thing that we need to mention is that these cases really go into the core of some of the analytics extensions that we are talking about in the article. And I think what's important to point out here is that any direction that these cases will take will be significant not only for sport law and these issues that we are narrowly focusing on right now, but for intellectual property purposes in particular, it really will be a fantastic opportunity for us to learn more about what are the limits right now to digital expression and to the use of likenesses of people in terms of profit-making enterprises, including video game and other opportunities for a company and an individual to make a profit in a rapidly expanding digital world over the internet. So
the internet is an important factor here, and as we know, the law in that area is evolving. Another important case discussed in your article is American Needle versus NFL. And Professor Rodenberg, perhaps you could tell us about that case and how it relates to sports law analytics.
Sure, I could speak to that. A very unique case. So January of 2010, so about a year and a half ago, the case was orally argued before the U.S. Supreme Court, the highest court in the land. And essentially the argument that the NFL, as a defendant, was putting forth was that as a single entity, we're not 32 individually owned teams, we're a single entity of which is the NFL football, which is our product.
A single league.
Exactly, a single league, and thereby we are immune to any antitrust lawsuits whatsoever. And the plaintiff was actually a small embroidery shop outside of Chicago that used to make hats that were officially licensed by individual teams. They became aggrieved when the NFL signed a across-the-board exclusive licensing arrangement with Reebok. Essentially, the book of business that American Needle, the small embroidery shop, used to have with a few individual teams that they contracted with specifically, was gone. They were upset about that. They filed an antitrust lawsuit. Before it got to the Supreme Court, the NFL actually won twice at both the district court level as well as the Court of Appeals level. American Needle, as plaintiff, was upset about that, so they filed an appeal to the U.S. Supreme Court. But in a very unique move that you don't see too often, the NFL actually filed an appeal as well, even though they had won the lower court case.
Hmm.
So the U.S. Supreme Court agreed to take the case. Oral arguments, like I mentioned, were in January 2010. However, in a unanimous decision about exactly a year ago, May 2010, John Paul Stevens, the eldest justice of the U.S. Supreme Court, did author an opinion unanimously that the U.S. Supreme Court overruled the lower court and did find that the NFL, for purposes of intellectual property licensing, was definitively not a single entity. So from the analytics perspective, certainly became very germane, because now the case has been kicked back to the district court, which is the trial court in the U.S. court system. And certainly both sides, as they go through discovery, where each side provides documentation and information to the other before you get to trial, analytics is going to play a big role, and it's going to be twofold. First, certainly American Needle, as plaintiff, needs to be able to prove damages. And certainly losing the existing business they had is pretty easy to calculate, but they also have to be able to do some forecasting. And certainly the professionals that read Analytics Magazine and those that are in decision sciences and operation research, that's something they do almost every day. And the second prong of American Needle's analytics that they're going to need to look towards is, what's the impact on consumers? Because certainly that's a relevant inquiry under antitrust jurisprudence. You have to be able to prove there's some detrimental impact on consumers. In a very simplistic way, you could say, well, hats used to be $10, and now they're $20, and the price has doubled, and that's a detrimental impact for consumers.
Uh-huh.
Unfortunately, it's not that simple. So certainly both sides are going to be hiring, frankly, a bevy of experts to try to prove their case, and some of those will make their way actually to testify at trial. But the vast majority, as I mentioned earlier, will probably just be retained as consultants. And depending on what those consultants tell their the side that they're working for, that actually could give a little more motivation to one side to settle the case.
Professor Rodenberg, I know that you have to leave in a moment, so I'll ask you one last quick question. Your article discusses the rules of evidence and precedent and how they relate to sports law analytics. Did you want to quickly address that?
Absolutely, and certainly the American court system, as well as our friends over in Great Britain, follow what's called the common law system, and certainly precedent between cases through the years plays a big, big role. And certainly if the U.S. Supreme Court or other Supreme Courts in individual states decide a case in a certain way, it's required that lower courts file that precedent. And they can't deviate absent a fact pattern or a legal issue that's substantially different. That aspect is really important in terms of when these cases actually get to litigation. The other aspect, and we go into quite a bit of detail about this in the paper, there was a mid-1990s case by the U.S. Supreme Court called Daubert versus Merrill Dow Pharmaceuticals. The underlying fact pattern actually had to do with birth defects that certain children were suffering, and plaintiffs were alleging that it came from the pharmaceuticals that certain women were taking while they're pregnant. But the case actually turned on what is considered a valuable and technical type of evidence that is admissible in court. And the court decided this case in the mid-90s. Shortly thereafter, the U.S. Congress revised their federal rules of evidence, and these are the rules that every federal court has to follow. And they were very specific in what used to be called the Frye standard, F-R-Y-E. It's now been changed to this Daubert standard. It's been codified in Federal Rules of Evidence 702. And for analytics professionals, a lot of the terminology and the language used in the court case, as well as the rules of evidence, is probably very familiar, because there's a certain three-pronged determination that that judges go through when they determine whether testimony is in fact admissible in court. And they talk about things as if it's has it been peer reviewed? Has the theory or technique been tested out in the field? Things like that, in terms of whether it's been scientifically accepted and the community of science accepts this type of methodology or conclusions, those are the type of things that judges look for. But frankly, those are the type of things that academics and professionals who use analytics do every day. And so I think it's a good move that a little over 15 years ago that these type of standards have been very specifically set forth, just because it allows for consistency. And consistency is certainly something that judges as well as litigants look for when they're hiring experts to help them in litigation.
Professor Rodenberg, thank you so much for joining us. And I'm going to continue with some questions for Professor Kabarakis.
Thank you, Barry. I appreciate it.
Professor Kabarakis, a 2009 case involving NASCAR illustrates the power and pitfalls of sports law analytics. Could you tell us what was at issue and how did sports law analytics factor in?
So, yes, that is one of our favorite cases, and I wish Ryan could be with us because he has a fascinating way of telling that tale. But essentially, the plaintiff alleged that NASCAR and one of their affiliates violated federal antitrust laws, and when the plaintiff's application for an elite-level competition event was not granted, the plaintiff was preempted and was unsuccessful in landing that bid, and that particular case revolved around essentially how the particular analytical tests would be applied from a particular expert witness that has been frequently called to deliver testimony in cases, in particular in the sport industry. As that particular case found, the expert's own version of a well-accepted analytic pertaining to consumer substitution in the marketplace was not tested. It hadn't been subject to peer review and publication. There were no standards controlling it. There was no way of determining that it enjoyed general acceptance within the scientific community, so there was quite a bit of negative feedback for the use of that particular method and that particular expert witness. So that was a good lesson to have, as were other cases that involved particular expert witnesses that had either pre-planned their testimony way too much with their counsel, or they engaged in what we generally call the hired gun strategy, and trying to really try to tweak their research and findings into what would really work well for a particular plaintiff or defendant, or whichever side they were going to serve.
We touched on this a little bit before, but another section of your article deals with analytics and intellectual property litigation. Why is analytics so broadly used in this area today?
I could honestly talk about this until the cows come home. I'm definitely a dedicated intellectual property lover, as well as others in our field. And the reason for that is that a lot of us feel that this is the most dynamic, evolving, and just absolutely fascinating for future research in legal scholarship, and particularly empirical legal scholarship as well. Now, intellectual property evolution has been parallel to the technology progress over the past few years, and it's fascinating to talk about intellectual property theory having its roots back to the late 19th century. There was an 1890 Right to Privacy Warren Brandeis article that talked about inventions and new business methods and photographs and newspaper enterprises that were invading the sacred precincts of private life, as the article said. And
so even then, new technology was a source of controversy.
Correct. And that was they predicted that what is whispered in the closet shall be proclaimed from the housetops. And this is really fascinating to think about the evolution now over the 20th century, and now particularly in the first 10 years of the new millennium, where we found we've taken such huge leaps in terms of digital expression and the internet being such a vast source of information, including what they were describing back in 1890, the opportunities for these methods to lead into invasions of privacy. And this is where intellectual property essentially had its theoretical underpinning. In terms of the rights of privacy, the right to protect somebody's image, and the right of publicity that is at the core of these particular cases right now, really has its roots in those writings. And courts later, after some other influential scholars such as Prosser and privacy articles in the 1960s, they took the next step to actually identify particular methods and particular concepts that would really identify how intellectual property should be protected in the new era.
And you mentioned the right of publicity. And how does analytics help an attorney state his case in an area like the right of publicity? And can you help me and our listeners by explaining the meaning of exactly what the right of publicity is?
Let's take a step back first and actually talk about the right of publicity. So as we mentioned earlier, there was quite a bit of theory and court decisions over the first and part of the 20th century, and after some scholarship, there was a lot more feedback for courts to actually try to decide these particular cases. There was also work from the American Law Institute and restatements of the law in terms of unfair competition, restatement of torts. And in the case of the right of publicity law, essentially the major concepts that pertain to the protection of the right of publicity is that a person's identity and the commercial value of it should be protected. So someone using someone's identity, and that included, and that is really important, Barry, to note, identity referred to anything from name, likeness, image, voice. You have such a tremendous expansion of what that meant. The notion was that it should be protected, and anyone using it without consent for profit should be subject to liability. So, talking about the analytics applications, if we take the restatement, for example, or if we take pretty much any state right of publicity statute that essentially revolves around the similar concepts such as the restatement posits, you talk about the use of plaintiff's identity, you talk about the identity having commercial value. So right there you already have an area where analytics can play a major role, whether the identity has commercial value. For example, there was the Pessina versus Midway case in the state of Illinois, where the analytics application to it was whether the model martial arts expert who was the model for that video game, if you recall, Mortal Kombat.
Very popular.
If the initial agreement was that they would use his motions and modeling for the arcade game, but they actually used it for the video game, the home video game as well, and he sued. And the evidence revolved around the question whether the public could be identifying the character in the video game with Pessina, the plaintiff. And only about 6%, I think, were able to identify it, or even lower, if I recall. And so essentially that was a good lesson in terms of how one could apply that. So in that case, it didn't have commercial value prior to that use. Other concepts revolve the appropriation of the commercial value for profit for purposes of trade, lack of consent, and obviously commercial injury. And the lack of consent is an important portion to it, because in cases such as the litigation right now, certain gray areas for the court to decide really could be derived from analytics research, and whether there was or consent or there was not. And closely, there is the federal claims. A lot of the right of publicity claims that plaintiffs use, they have to be state-based. So there are about 30 states now, either through common law or state statute, they recognize the right of publicity. But there's also a federal medium there, which is coming from the Trademark Act, the Lanham Act, Section 43A, 1A actually that describes the burden of proof. And in those concepts, you're talking about a mark that is legally protectable, and that reflects to a name, again, to voice, to likeness, and if it's protectable, so if the plaintiff owns that mark, which is easily proven in court if you're talking about likenesses and names and identities. And the crucial point in terms of analytics research is whether the defendant's use of the mark for profit is likely to create confusion concerning the question whether the plaintiff is sponsoring or not. So that is another major part of our research as well, to try to tease out whether there is a likelihood of confusion in terms of these video games cases where perhaps the video gaming, the gamers, the consuming public could be confused in terms of who would be endorsing these games or not.
We only have time for one or two more questions. Can you tell us more about analytics and antitrust litigation, perhaps returning to the American Needle versus NFL case that we discussed earlier?
That is definitely one area that Ryan has spent quite a bit of time discussing. My research on that front dates back quite a bit in terms of antitrust challenges, in terms of CAA amateurism rules as well. But in a nutshell, what would happen there is that, as Ryan mentioned earlier, in terms of the American Needle case, you would have to go into some basic analysis in terms of the anti-competitive versus pro-competitive effects of that's called the rule of reason. There were three accepted methods of leading to decisions in these antitrust cases: per se, rule of reason, and also the quick look analysis. And if you're talking about the rule of reason, which happens in most of these cases, essentially you have to weigh the pro-competitive versus the anti-competitive effect. Much like Ryan mentioned earlier for the American Needle case, you also have to look at longitudinal surveys and some evidence in terms of market surveys, and coming up with different models that would to the court perhaps deciding one way or the other how the pro-competitive effects perhaps of one restrictive practice could be overweight by the anti-competitive effects, which is essentially what happened to a major case in the past, the one of the two only cases that the NCAA has lost on antitrust grounds, which was the TV football situation in 1984 with a Supreme Court decision in Board of Regents, where there was analytics implemented there in terms of keeping institutions, the NCAA member institutions, out of TV and only offering the opportunity for two games. And that was found to be had a detrimental impact to the market, and it was anti-competitive. So that was one example.
Final question. Do you have any guiding advice to operations researchers who may be asked to offer expert testimony on sports law analytics?
And before our podcast, Ryan and I, we were discussing this being a very important part of the discussion, and that's where we feel that the article could perhaps play a small part to it, to actually open up the opportunities for more operation researchers and decision-making scientists, anyone that has a love and a passion for analytics research, to actually become more involved. And I think one of the main opportunities to do that would be through collaboration. And there are tremendous prospects now with our different academic disciplines evolving into more interdisciplinary fields and engaging in fascinating empirical legal studies for our purposes as well. And I would suggest that any operations researchers and decision-making scientists would that try to open up the doors and the horizons in terms of collaboration with law and business, and in our case, in these particular situations, a lot of the faculty that are focusing in sport management practices and sport law as well, get a good feel of a comfortable feeling working with lawyers in a way, and trying to anticipate arising legal issues, which happens with more experience, which happens with more reading of these types of related articles, and you will see a lot more of these types of projects now coming up from all aspects of the country in terms of empirical legal research and centers that are set up in various parts of the countries. Generally, I would say embrace working with knowledgeable, open-minded attorneys. They can be an operation researcher's and decision-making scientist's best friend because they need, I think they need the research and they need the analytics methods to actually prove their points and have a very solid point when they come up before litigation. Definitely need to stress the fact that they need to get to know the law firm network, the key firms that practice in its sector, essentially show that there is a good understanding of what research would be applicable in terms of particular those gray legal areas that a lot of analytics research can really help in providing solution right now. I'd say, you know, play up the work and passion about providing these solutions and then sell it to the law firms, working with expert witness lists, maintaining good websites with, you know, different informations about research. So on that point, I would also mention including tidbits of information, not everything, not works in progress, unpublished papers, working codes, models, and so on, but giving enough so that a potential litigating firm and attorney could actually have enough to be interested in the researcher's work to actually call and seek their advice for further research. Maybe join listservs of legal interests that are enough nowadays that will give a lot of value for those in analytics research. There are various ones in LinkedIn groups and social networks, I presume, as well. And essentially arrange for a nice collection of legal news and blogs and sites that would perhaps give those needle points that all of a sudden one of the points that are very close to the researcher's area of expertise would just pop up and they would say, oh, this is precisely up my alley, so I actually need to focus on. And humorously, judging from recent cases, we have to also mention that when the time comes, they should definitely remain balanced. Don't take sides too early. And if there's any final two Greek sense here, we would say let the research and the data speak, and that would be important when the time comes. If the researcher plans way too much over the preparation of the litigation, this could have a negative effect in terms of the litigation and the court's acceptance. There are examples of expert witnesses taking notes to the stand and having way too much preparation with their notes, so that was not really appreciated. So essentially remain balanced and let the research do the talking.
That's all the time we have today. We've been talking with Professor Ryan M. Rodenberg and Professor Anastasios Kabarakis, the authors of an article about sports analytics in the current issue of Analytics Magazine. Thank you so much for joining us. And thank you for listening to the Science of Better podcast by Informs, the Institute for Operations Research in the Management Sciences. For more about operations research and the series of podcasts, visit us on the web at www.informs.org. Good day, and remember, keep on crunching those numbers.